Welcome to Industry Insights, the EFM podcast presented by the European Film Market of the Berlinale. My name is Matt Carey. I'm the documentary editor at Deadline Hollywood, based in Los Angeles. Industry Insights, the EFM podcast, puts a spotlight on highly topical and trend-setting industry issues, creating a compass for the forthcoming film year. The year-round podcast is produced in cooperation with Goethe Institute and co-funded by Creative Europe Media. Today, with a highly topical episode about documentary filmmaking, a warm-up to all things documentary happening shortly at the relaunched EFM Doc Salon, taking place from February 14 to February 18 at the Café Connect in the Documentation Center for Displacement, Expulsion, and Reconciliation. It's just a three-minute walk from EFM's main location, Kropiasbau. Here you'll find the exclusive meeting point and home for the documentary industry. Joining us is acclaimed filmmaker Kazuhiro Soda, who came to the Berlinale last year to premiere his documentary, The Cats of Gokuku Shrine. This year, Kazuhiro, you are returning to the Berlinale in a different capacity, as a juror.
Right, yes.
And how excited are you for those duties?
Very much so. My career started from Berlinale, like in 2007, when I had my debut film called Campaign. And without Berlinale, I don't have a career. So I feel very honored and fortunate that I can return to the Berlinale. My previous films, five films of mine have been shown at the Berlinale. Mm. And so, you know, Berlinale has been a really special festival for me.
So in competition for the documentary prize this year, there are 16 films that are drawn right. from various categories, including competition, Berlinale Special, Panorama, Forum, and Generation. We're not going to, of course, ask you for commentary on any of the films, mm-hmm. but I wonder if you can say anything about how you anticipate evaluating the films. Are there any particular criteria that you go in with?
Well, I'll just try to have a fresh look. I try not to have any anticipation.
Well, I think that fits with your overall view of how documentary filmmakers really should approach their work.
Yeah, that's because, exactly. Yeah. Yes, I have my own 10 commandments of filmmaking. Yes. And my policy number one is I do not do any research before shooting because I'd like to have my head like neutral and empty and try to look and listen carefully and attentively and find out whatever I find out. And then I make a film based on my discoveries. So I'd like to take a same approach to selecting the award from the 16 films we're going to watch.
And so some of your other commandments, in addition to doing no research, are no meeting with subjects, no
right.
scripts.
Mm-hmm.
Roll the camera yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Shoot for as long as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Cover small areas deeply. Do not set up a theme or goal before editing.
Right.
No narration, superimposed titles, or music. Use mm-hmm. long takes. And finally, the 10th commandment, pay for the production yourself.
Right.
Those are not easy. Maybe the last one is the most difficult in terms of financing a project. But why are those concepts important to you and you feel really lead to the most revelatory kinds of documentary filmmaking?
Well, documentary filmmaking has been kind of institutionalized. And it's great on one hand. You know, you have a lot of resources. You have a potential to gain a lot of resources. But at the same time, it kind of bind the filmmakers in a certain way. And I wanted to be free from it. And so I am taking this radical approach. And commandment number 10 is particularly important because financial freedom is the creative freedom. You cannot have a creative freedom without the financial freedom.
As I looked at both those commandments and then thinking about them in light of your films, the filmmaker who sprang to my mind, at least that people would know around the world and in the U.S., is Frederick Wiseman.
Right.
who's been very independent, but also I think follows a number of those precepts, if you will, as well. And I know that you are based in New York, where there is a retrospective going on right now at Film at Lincoln Center of Frederick Wiseman's films. Mm-hmm. How much of a role model or inspiration has he been to you?
Very much so, yeah. He was my inspiration. Yeah, it was because of him I started my own productions. I used to make TV shows. I was a TV director before that. And I was frustrated with the way, you know, TV shows were being made. You know, I had to do a lot of research before shooting. I had to write a detailed script. I had to follow it. And
exactly what you yeah, don't want to do anymore. Right. Decided you didn't want to do.
Exactly. And, you know, I didn't have the editorial control ultimately. And I always fought with the producers. And I realized, you know, they have the final say because they are paying for it and I don't pay for it. So, and then I saw some of the Frederick Wiseman's films and I remember the first one I saw was Domestic Violence in 2001 or 2002. And I was blown away and I started watching his films like, at the library in New York.
Ah.
And I saw.
At the New York Public Library?
Exactly.
Well, I only mention that because, of course, then he later directed a film about the New York Public Library.
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah. Yeah. That's how I kind of learned his craft and his approach to documentary filmmaking. So when I started my own production, you know, I was totally influenced by his films and method.
I spoke with him just a couple of weeks ago about the retrospective. And, you know, don't want to make this all about Fred Wiseman, but only to say that, you know, as you're probably very aware, he's not a great fan of what is often called cinema verite, sometimes called direct cinema. He really draws a distinction in his work where he says he's not doing that. He believes it's a very, very subjective art form. And he's really constructing dramas through his work. What are your feelings about sort of the cinema verite tradition, which sort of implicitly suggests that there's an objective element to, well, you're just recording whatever it is you see, and you're sort of a neutral character as a filmmaker.
Well, I don't think, you know, direct cinema or cinema verite is objective at all, you know. No.
Yes.
It's very subjective. That's why I call my films observational cinema. I wanted to redefine observation, the word observation, because it's quite misunderstood, the word, you know, the concept of observation. When we say observation, people imagine it's neutral, it's like you are a third party and you are objective. Mm-hmm. No, because there is someone who's observing, you know. And so it's very subjective. But so when I say observation, it is about not, it's not about being neutral. It's not about being distant. It's about looking and listening carefully and being open to new discoveries, rather than we have plan, we have agenda, but we want to get rid of that by looking and listening carefully and being open to whatever is happening in front of you. But the way you interpret what's happening is very subjective, and you construct the film according to your subjective view. So in a sense, I agree with Wiseman, and at the same time, I don't really care how it's called, you know, like, you know, whether it's a direct cinema or cinema verite. I don't really care about how it's called, you know. What I care is about looking and listening carefully.
And you say that in one of your commandments is, as you mentioned, is no research beforehand. But how do you decide on the areas that you want to focus on? In other words,
Right.
How you decide what you want to make a film about, where you want to go to make that film.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an encounter, you know. Mm-hmm. It's always like these things come to you. I don't really look for a theme. I don't really look for a subject. They come to me. For example, my latest film, The Cats of Gokoku Shrine. The shrine, you know, I used to live in New York, but we moved to this place called Ushimado in Japan.
Ah, I see.
It's a rural countryside, and it's a seaside town. And there is one, you know, small shrine about like 10 seconds away from us, from where we live. It's called Gokoku Shrine. And there are many cats living there, street cats living there. And we became friends with these cats. So that kind of inspired me to make a film about them. So, you know, it's always this kind of like encounter first. I don't have a theme to prove. I don't have something I want to say. It's not about that. It's about chance encounter. You know, I encounter something. I get curious. I get interested. So then, you know, I start filming and then see what happens.
So, yeah, so it just emerges really organically from your experience and observation of the world.
Right.
It is very interesting to note that cats are in many of your films in one way or another, like Oyster Factory, Peace, Mental Theater 1, and Theater 2.
Right.
And it strikes me that perhaps, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but there's a bit of a parallel between your approach to cinema and what we think of, and what we know of cats, of they're very observant creatures.
Exactly.
They don't miss anything.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, the minute they hear the noise of a treat.
Oh, yes. Right.
100 meters away, you know, they come.
Is there, beyond that, is there any particular reason why cats, you know, continue to make appearances in your films? And
the biggest reason is that I love them.
Okay, that's a very good reason.
And whenever I see them on the street, you know, I have no choice but to film them. And they end up, you know, becoming part of the film. So I adore them. And it became kind of like a signature for me. Like, Hitchcock appears, himself. And in my case, it's the cats.
I see. Yeah, that makes absolutely sense to me. And I was curious of your sense about the state of distribution for documentary film in Japan, because I think the audience will be interested to know about that. Your film Zero from 2020, that was distributed by Tofu Films.
Right.
NNC 2018 by Rock Salt Releasing. And I just wonder how that has evolved over time with your films, and how you assess the state of distribution, because it's such a challenge for so many documentary filmmakers around the world right now.
Yeah, it's getting harder and harder, I think. All of my films have been distributed in Japan, in cinemas, in about like 30, 40 cinemas across the nation. And I've been lucky to make a living by doing that. But it's not so, it's getting more difficult because of the, I think, streaming services and the YouTube, and we are competing, you know, with that kind of new media. And people kind of stopped going to cinemas. And I feel very alarmed and sad about that. We have to do something about it. Otherwise, I think cinema will die. And I don't want to live in world which has no cinemas. Yeah, because I love cinemas, yeah.
And of course, that's one of the most important elements of a film festival, especially a major film festival like the Berlinale, where for so many filmmakers, particularly on the documentary side, that is maybe their only opportunity to have,
right,
to show their films in a theater.
Yeah, yeah.
That they intended it to be seen as. It's just not guaranteed by any means.
Right.
Yeah, in the U.S., since COVID, there's really a decline in opportunities for films to be, documentary films to be released in theaters. But again, as you're sort of alluding to, much of that has to do with streaming services, which are not interested in naturally in theatrical distribution. And so we don't know if some of the films that go to them might have done well, for instance, in theaters or not. It's not really being tested in that sense. But at the Berlinale, you obviously have some fantastic venues to see films. It must be very exciting as a filmmaker to be there and to know that an audience is going to encounter your film for the very first time in that way.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I feel alive, you know. And, even if, you know, it's a film I've seen so many times, my own film, it feels like I'm watching it for the first time with the audience. I mean, it's a communal experience in cinemas, you know. Like, we are sitting in the dark and watching the same screen. And we don't really look at each other's, but we feel how people are feeling, you know, like people are bored, people are really attentive, people are so enjoying. We feel that while watching the film. And it's something you cannot feel when you're watching it alone in your room on your smartphones, you know. And it's a really a communal experience, and it's kind of like a communication, you know, to each others, not only to the film, but also each others among the audience. So, yeah, I think it has some sort of meaning in the human community, and it's needed.
Yeah, there's kind of like a triangulation, if you will. In other words, it's not simply filmmaker through their film and the person watching it, but you have this other dimension the joint experience of seeing it with other human beings. And you're picking up on those cues, whether you're conscious of it or not, of how they're responding.
Exactly. And, you know, even if you didn't find certain scenes, you know, funny, but if somebody else is laughing, you know, that kind of affects, gives you a kind of cue to find it funny, you know. And, yeah, so it's really a wonderful, wonderful way of watching a film.
How influential would you say that your Ten Commandments have been on documentary filmmaking in Japan?
I hope it has good influence. Sometimes I get like DVDs or link, you know, screening links from current like working TV directors who are inspired by my Ten Commandments and tried on TV. also I get like, I've written like 10 books in Japanese, and some, you know, younger filmmakers express the fact that they were inspired and they were influenced by my books, and you know, they are now approach, you know, making films according to, you know, whatever I described in the book. So yeah, I hope I made some small contribution, you know, to the film culture in Japan.
Well, film culture around the world, absolutely. And of course, the people will remember that last year the Golden Bear went to a documentary, Dahomey, directed by Maddie Diop.
Right.
And No Other Lamb, which is nominated for an Academy Award, won the documentary prize at the festival. So we look forward to what you and your fellow jurors, Petra Costa and Leah Globe, will choose as the winner this year. And so good luck with those deliberations. And thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, Kazuhiro Soda.
Thank you so much, Matt. And see you in Berlin.
All right. We'll see you. We're very pleased to be joined now by Lois Boston, who is the founding executive producer of Independent Lens, which is a program of ITVS. This is the long-running series that runs on public television stations in the United States. Lois, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Matt. It's great to always be with you.
You're just back from the Sundance Film Festival, which I think offers a really fresh perspective on the state of documentary, certainly in the U.S., but around the world. And you brought, with ITVS, you brought four films that premiered
five,
including the film that won the Grand Jury Prize for U.S. Documentary, Seeds. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a very interesting Sundance.
Interesting in what respect, would you say?
Well, I was saying to somebody the other day, it was a little bit of two different worlds. There was our world where we had five docs, four of them that are currently slated to, independent lens docs, and then a fifth doc that ITVS supported with American Masters. And they were all really, really well received. And so the film teams were having a great time. Audiences were really receptive. But then there was sort of this other Sundance, which was, I thought, a little quiet. And maybe even a little nervous. There was obviously conversations about the fires in Los Angeles, the state of the media industry writ large, and then, of course, larger things happening in the world with the wars that were going on, and the big question about where was Sundance going to move to after next year's festival. And that felt more, as I said, a little bit tepid or a little bit just unsure.
Yes, and your film for American Masters is Marley Matlin, Not Alone Anymore, which is about the Oscar-winning actress Marley Matlin, directed by Shoshana Stern. Really wonderful film. I had an opportunity to speak with them at Sundance. But interestingly, a number of films, of course, came in with distribution. Many do not at Sundance. And that'll be the case for many of the documentaries premiering in the Berlinale. They don't necessarily have distribution, but it was very, very quiet in terms of acquisitions, at least during Sundance. One short documentary was acquired. So far, no announcements of acquisitions of any documentaries from the festivals. That has to be a bit concerning.
Yeah, I think it does speak to where we are right now, in that after sort of that golden era when there was a lot of money going out toward docs, the streamers were funding, and so they were coming to Sundance with docs or acquiring them right before Sundance, as happened even last year or out of Sundance. But I think now they're looking to see what is going to resonate with audiences, and they're not as quick to make those offers. So it is, yeah, it is an interesting time, obviously. I think what it's forcing the documentary community to do is to sort of look at how we've managed this in the past and to come up with new ways to get docs out into the world.
And of course, at an independent lens, you are investing in and supporting and providing a platform for documentaries from around the world.
Yeah.
So does show on American television. However, it's an independent lens on the entire world.
Yeah. I think the other thing to note is that we've spent a lot of energy and creativity in the last 5, 6 years figuring out ways to get those films, our documentaries, out to audiences on streaming platforms. And we're, of course, limited because we're a part of the public media platform. So, but we're working with PBS YouTube and we're working with the PBS app and other sources. Because as we know, broadcast is changing. Broadcast audiences have been trained to go to streaming. So for us, a big focus is on continuing. This last season, we tripled our streaming audience, and that's our goal again this season, is to, again, at least triple that streaming audience. And I think that's a new thing for some filmmakers to grasp, is that we're not a broadcast series, we're actually a multi-platform series.
Yeah, so you're not simply tied to linear broadcast in the US. And in terms of the PBS app, is it geofenced to the US or
Yeah,
is it
yes.
available?
No, everything, the PBS YouTube, PBS app, PBS Passport, they're all, well, PBS Passport does have some bleed over into Canada just across the border. But yeah, they're all geo-filtered. So it still is, we're still only looking for U.S. distribution. We recognize that our partners in other countries across the world will be the, the proper home for these docs.
Through the years, the films that you have supported and backed have won 10 Academy Award nominations, 70 Peabody, Emmy, and DuPont Columbia Awards. So these are films that have been lauded, far and wide. Interestingly, you and I spoke just a couple of months ago at the IDA Awards, the International Documentary Association Awards, there where you won Best Curated Series. And you had something interesting to say about some of the material that you look for. And you told me at that point that it's something nobody else would fund. So we need to fund it. Or it is something else that none of us have ever seen before on the commercial media. So we need to support it. So those interesting values, and I think would bring a lot of encouragement to filmmakers who don't want to necessarily work within strict genres.
Yeah. Well, that's always been true. That was our reason. That was the reason we were created by Congress, was to really be a place that would support and champion those stories, those filmmakers who couldn't get into, and of course, back when we started, there were many fewer opportunities and platforms for documentary. But if you look at Sundance, for example, Seeds is something that, along with Black Public Media, we put development money into back in 2019. And it's a very cinematic film about Black farmers, filmed in black and white. It's not something that would be an obvious choice for other funders to fund. But we felt, first of all, a great trust in the first-time director, who was also a really brilliant cinematographer, and her producer, who we've worked with before. But more to the point, we really feel it's those kinds of stories that the American public wants and needs to see about each other, now probably more than ever. In a time when we seem to have so much divisiveness, we're only going to work through that divisiveness by seeing each other. And so we have to see each other as we are. Or even if you look at Life After, Reed Davenport's film about disability rights. Again, we first funded that film when Reed was going to make it as a short. And then, you know, in developing the project, he decided he wanted to make a feature. And so then we funded it as a feature. But it's also another perfect example of a voice, a community that is so underrepresented, the voice of disabled people speaking on their own behalf. And as you said earlier, Marley Matlin, the same thing. The filmmaker herself is deaf, and it's one of the first times that a deaf filmmaker has made a documentary about another deaf subject. So those are the stories that we're really interested in. Our challenge is to help filmmakers find ways to tell those stories in formats, lengths, different ways that we can actually reach a wide audience, especially now with an emphasis on finding people through streaming, because that is how most of us find documentaries.
Mm-hmm. And I wondered about, in terms of the international audience potentially for these films, because there may be listeners who are in a position to acquire or consider acquiring films. How would they go about, if for instance, ITVS has U.S. domestic rights, how would they go about trying to get international rights for a film like that? Would they go through the filmmakers? Would they contact you? Or?
Well, they're happy. We're happy to have them contact me. But yes, I would then introduce them to the filmmakers. And I would say, you know, even the other two films we had at Sundance are both prime examples of documentaries that we think would be a great fit for international audiences. The Librarians by Kim Snyder looks at the current rise of book banning across the United States. And we know that is not unique to the United States by any means. And the film is really focused on the librarians in these little tiny towns, and some not so tiny towns, across the United States who are fighting to keep books in the hands of readers. So we would think that that film would have legs outside the United States, as well as Tad Nakamura's beautiful film Third Act, which looks at the life of his father, the great Asian American filmmaker Robert Nakamura, but it's also about internment in Japanese camps during World War II. It's about his father getting Parkinson's late in life. It's about father-son relationships. It's about, I say to people, it's about everything. It's about forgiveness. It's about how do you come out of a camp where you're told that your people are not worthy of living in the United States and then go on to become one of the great filmmakers that our country has produced. And that subject matter is also, as we know, not unique to the United States. So I think all of the films have international value and interest, but I would say those two, to me, feel like they could be perfect fits for a lot of the partners we work with around the world, a lot of the public broadcasters, as well as some of the commercial outlets.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned The Librarians and Third Act, which both either directly or indirectly very much speak to the current political environment in the United States. The Librarians, very directly so, as you mentioned, directed by Kim A. Snyder, who is Oscar nominated this year for the short documentary Death by Numbers. So she's been very, very busy heading to the Academy Awards in just a few weeks. The Librarians, one of the executive producers is the actress Sarah Jessica Parker. Spoke with Sarah Jessica Parker and Kim Snyder and several of the librarians at Sundance. It's really shocking what's happening to these people who are simply trying to abide by essentially the oath of librarians, which is to share access to books with young people, inquisitive minds. They're not forcing anyone to read books by any means. They're just trying to facilitate learning, whatever direction that goes in. But boy, they are being vilified, attacked, threatened with, I mean, death threats. It's very, very alarming and speaks to this rise of, well, I'm not sure how to describe it other than hate in the United States.
Yeah, the film itself is very emotional. It's also powerful because you see the power that one person can have when they resist or when they fight for what they think is right. I think that that particular subject matter is international, sadly. We know it's happening in other countries as well as politics become so divisive.
And I don't necessarily want to drag you into U.S. domestic politics, although they inevitably have an influence around the world. But when we did speak in December at the IDA Awards, you know, you noted, which I think is true, that all public institutions are facing an interesting time because the current administration, you know, really, it's just all bets are off in terms of what anything that we took for granted in terms of even what the nature of our democracy is. So it's a difficult time, certainly for executives like yourself, and we do rely on documentary filmmakers, I think, to bring light and energy onto these issues as they become all the more important.
Yeah, and I think that will be, as you just said, all the more important. I think in the years ahead, the thing about independent documentary filmmakers that I've always been so humbled by and encouraged by is that they will tell those stories. They just don't give up. They are compelled to tell these stories because they feel a need to shed light on something that they think, you know, needs to be shared. And I've been doing this now a while, and I've just seen filmmakers prevail in very difficult circumstances with, sadly, very little resources, and create incredible documentaries. I think of, you know, Raoul Peck's film, I Am Not Your Negro, which we did not have a lot of funding for that documentary, but it was a story that had to come out at that time. And I think that's true of so many of these documentaries, that they come out at the moment that they're meant to come into the world. And the filmmakers will persist. Of that, I am sure. And I think that there are enough people and funders, both private and public, who will continue to support the work. But we are in a very big transitional time. That's true.
Mm. How closely will you be keeping an eye on the Berlinale and the films that are both premiering there and in a few cases, films that have premiered elsewhere? You're certainly very much aware of the slate.
Yeah, I love to keep track of that slate because obviously I'm a great admirer of the work that gets championed there. And when you look at you know, even this year's Oscar list, I don't think No Other Land would be up for an Oscar had it not had a premiere last year in Berlin. And this year, I mean, there are several on the slate that I think are going to be very interesting. Raoul Peck is back with a new film on George Orwell. There are a couple of U.S. filmmakers that I've had the pleasure of working with, Brandon Kramer and Lance Kramer and Yoni Brook, who did Yoni worked on our wonderful docuseries, Philly DA. They're going to be in Berlin with a new film called Holding Liat. There's the new film on Elon Musk. So I think there's, again, movies coming out at the time when the world sort of needs them. I was saying to Raoul Peck the other day that I can't imagine a more appropriate time for a film on George Orwell right in this moment. And he's been working on that film for a long time. So again, it's sort of a case of the film meeting the moment.
Absolutely. And you mentioned the, or, and I mentioned it too. Everyone's thinking about it. I think the Academy Awards coming up on March 2nd. You're a member of the documentary branch of the Oscars. So we will not ask you for any particulars on the nominations. However, it is very interesting to note that similarly to last year, that all of the subject matters of the films that are nominated for Best Documentary Feature are international in scope, as we were discussing earlier with Kazuhiro Soda. So that's a testament to the that films from around the world really are reaching the Academy and are being evaluated and taken very seriously.
Yeah, I know the Academy has put real effort into internationalizing all of their branches, specifically the doc branch. They had a very sincere effort to make documentary filmmakers around the world feel included, because cinema is still a universal language. It is, along with music, one of the things that travels around the world and has impact no matter where it's shown. That's always been true. And I think, again, as the world has become both smaller and more fractured at the same time, the power of cinema is really essential right now. And so the documentary branch internationally has really been, you know, strengthened. And the fact that last year and this year, all of the nominations are international in subject matter, I think, is a reflection of that.
Absolutely. And we're going to be all on tenterhooks awaiting the Academy Awards.
Yeah, but it's a bit of a, you know, some years you can really call it. You can sort of see there's been a trend. One film has just won every other award. But this year, I think it's a little bit of a, I think there is some real suspense in what is actually going to win the Oscar because of the state of the world. Yeah.
Yes, and just not too many days ago, the Directors Guild of America Awards were held, and Porcelain War won that film, which was also nominated for the Academy Award, directed by Brendan Belomo and Slava Leontiev, set in Ukraine, of course. So got a little bit of extra boost there. But as you look at the documentary field in general and in the maybe foreseeable future, what is your assessment of the landscape of it, either in terms of distribution and opportunities or the challenges that filmmakers are likely to face?
Yeah, I think the opportunities and the challenges lie in the exact same place, distribution. I think that as commercial outlets have pulled back on documentary, or at least on social issue documentary. I know they're still doing a lot of nonfiction work, but on the kinds of films that we're talking about, it is forcing the field itself to find new ways to distribute. And I don't think we've cracked the nut yet, but I do know even at this last Sundance, there were gatherings, and there's a town hall happening next week or 2 weeks from now with a wide group of people in the field, people who work directly in distribution, but people who are funders, people who are filmmakers, to talk more collaboratively about how we're going to bring all of this together. And 30 years ago, it wasn't easy to distribute documentaries, but we figured out ways and we built up this incredible ecosystem. That ecosystem is obviously now undergoing a dramatic change, but I do believe that we will create new opportunities. And I think it's going to lie in literally cracking the nut on how we're going to find a platform that supports more documentary. And I still am a believer in public media, of course, because as somebody said to me just last week, it is the only place where we're interested in ideas and we're not driven by money. Obviously, we need to, you know, find ways to get money into the hands of filmmakers and have enough money to market the docs so that we can find an audience, which has become harder and harder. But I think that that feeling that these stories are essential to conversations in a free and democratic society, that's not lost. And so I just believe that filmmakers will continue to push and they'll continue to be creative. They are creative people by their very nature, and that we will find a way to get back into the conversation in a platform of some sort. And ultimately, what I really believe is that audiences want to know what's going on, and they're pretty hungry at a time when they may not trust mainstream media as much as they used to. And so documentary filmmakers have an incredible role to play in that as well.
Well, we thank you for that hopeful message. Clearly not one without challenges for all people who want to try to make a film, and that really goes for narrative fictional content as well as documentary. But thank you so much, Lois Boston, for offering your perspective on the state of documentary filmmaking with special emphasis on the United States. Lois Boston, the founding executive producer of Independent Lens, which is a program of ITVS. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much, Matt. I'm really sorry I can't be in Berlin in person. It's going to be a wonderful festival. I hope you have a great time, and good luck to all the filmmakers who are launching.
Thank you so much. Industry Insights is produced in cooperation with the Goethe Institute and co-funded by Creative Europe Media. From February 14 to February 18, the EFM Doc Salon will serve as an exclusive meeting point for the documentary industry, where all documentary activities ranging from talks, networking, consultations, and roundtables will take place within the EFM Industry Sessions Conference and Networking Program. This all happens in the Café Connect in the Documentation Center for Displacement, Expulsion, and Reconciliation, just a three-minute walk from Gropiusbau. The main partner of the Doc Salon is FFF Bayern, and Deadline is the media partner. Please do tune in to future episodes of Industry Insights. Find us wherever you get your podcasts and on the website of the European Film Market, www.efm-berlinale.de. Thank you again to our guests, Kazuhiro Soda and Lois Boston. I'm Matt Carey with Deadline.com. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye.